Hey, everybody, I'm Nick Layton.
And I'm Leah Bonema.
And we're the hosts of Were You Raised by Wolves?
Each week, we try to make the world a kinder, nicer place.
Well, that's the idea, at least.
I mean, we try.
Have you ever wondered what to do if you're ghosted?
Or what to do when a friend asks you to borrow money?
Or the proper way to eat Cheetos?
You know, the big questions.
So please find Were You Raised by Wolves wherever you listen.
You're listening to Heritage Radio Network. Since 2009, HRN podcasts have been exploring the wide world of food, beverage, and agriculture. Learn more at heritageradionetwork.org.
This episode of Cutting the Curd is brought to you by Comté Cheese Association. Comté, an iconic cheese from the Jura Mountains of France, favored by cheesemongers and cheese lovers all over the world. Find out more at comté-usa.com. That's comté-usa.com.
Hello, everyone. I am Carlos Descas, and for this episode, we're talking about one of my favorite topics, raw milk cheese. What is it and what is not? I must confess that since leaving the Old West Cheese Coalition last November, my engagement with the political conversation in the U.S. around raw milk cheese has diminished. I am aware of the continued pressure New York State raw milk cheese makers have and renewed efforts by the FDA and the CDC to limit even further our right to choose raw milk cheeses. This is not a new story, but increasingly I feel like we have lost a battle, if not the war. That's why today we're looking at the bay world of unpasteurized, thermalized cheese. Before we go into this conversation, I want to say that I do agree with Trevor Warmenthal, aka Milk Trekker. He recently wrote in his newsletter that creating a hard divide between raw and pasteurized cheeses is perhaps the wrong approach when trying to support small cheesemakers and traditional cheesemaking practices on the ground. If you haven't read their newsletter, I encourage you to subscribe by following him on Instagram. I should mention that Trevor is the 2022 recipient of the DCTA, the Travel Scholarship of the Daphne Cephas Teaching Endowment. I am the current president of the DCTE, and I can tell you the organization is delighted with his proposal to document and further understand the world of traditional coagulants. During my tenure at Old West Cheese Coalition, we encourage cheesemakers around the world to differentiate between raw, unpasteurized, and pasteurized milk cheeses. Our aim was to make clear to the consumer that there were different products and that each one has a place. We differentiated raw from unpasteurized because we understood that increasingly some producers are heating their milks to below pasteurization levels. There are many reasons for this, but I think it's a technical response to a policy question. Regulators around the world have created a myth of danger around raw milk, but consumers still want the choice. Therefore, producers are being pushed and pulled from both sides. To bring the perspective of the producer, I have asked my friend Mariano Gonzalez to speak to me. He is currently the head cheesemaker at Grafton Billy's Cheese Company in Vermont. There, he makes unpasteurized milk cheeses, including delicious cheddars and a hard cow and sheep's milk cave-aged cheese named Sheep's Hog that is my favorite. Mariano is originally from Paraguay and initially moved to the U.S. in 1987 and started working at Shelburne Farms. He briefly returned to Paraguay to set up a demonstration farm to develop a cheese industry there, but it ended up returning to California in 2001. He has worked with the USAID as part of the farmer-to-farmer program, helping develop the cheese industry in Central and South America. Bienvenido al show, Mariano.
Muchas gracias por tenerme en tu show, Carlos. Es un placer.
Thank you. Well, both our mother language is Spanish. Mariano and I will talk in English today. I hope one day we will have a show in Espanol. But for now, we'll do this in English.
I'm sorry.
Okay.
Thank you very much for having me in your show. And I'm so grateful to be here.
Great. Thank you, Mariano. Mariano, you and I have known each other for a long time. I've been to visit the caves at Grafton, in the middle of the pandemic, and I'm always in awe of everything you do. Today, I want to talk about your role in making those cheeses that are you making at Grafton, because you're making, you have a very good quality of milk. You could totally be making raw milk cheeses, but still some of your cheeses are being unpasteurized, meaning that they're being treated with heat treatment. So let's dive in and then we'll talk about, you know, your experience, but I want to head this on. So what is your decision about, when do you make the decision that you're either going to make raw milk or unpasteurized, meaning that you are going to be heat treating some of the milk?
For making the decision of when we're going to heat treat the milk or not, it really depends of knowing the milk source that we have. We normally do not pasteurize any milk. Everything is heat treated. And by saying that, we are basically treating the milk to a very low temperature, below pasteurization, so we can just ensure the microbial content of the milk, it gets a little bit lower, because we don't produce milk for Grafton specifically. So we buy the milk from local small farms around the area where we are located, and is a basically commercial milk. So we don't have a direct control of the milk. So in that scenario, we just desire to get the approach of thermalize the milk to a certain temperature where we are still be able to say it's raw milk.
And so I understand the decision is made because you don't control the milk. You want to lower the bacterial activity. Do you have a feeling that if you were making, if you were producing your own milk, if Grafton was producing its own milk, would it be better to keep the milk to make your cheeses raw? Or would you still make this decision?
Oh, absolutely. Just let me go a little bit back in history.
Sure.
When I was in Shulburn Farms, a very small group of cow. So at that time we were milking 100 cows, and we did have control of the quality and the milking practices and where the milk was produced. So we were controlling that with how the cow is sanitized, the diet of the cow, the environmental aspect of the cow, where they're going to be, what pastures. And so the milk in there, we have extremely high control of what the cows were producing, unless the cow was get some kind of infections. But those cows were removed out of the herd, and the milk that I was receiving there was completely raw milk. So with that said, from the cheesemaker perspective, you have a more, you are more sure that you're getting a high quality milk, raw milk, to work with very low bacterial or pathogens in the milk.
Right. So it is really about the source of this milk. What was the case in California?
Oh, in California also was pretty the same approach that I took working with the Fiscalini family. They were very open to change some of the systems and some of the breed of cows, and they were very into produce high quality raw milk cheese. So the approach was similar in there. It would all the milkers were retrain and ensure that they follow specific procedures in order to minimize any contamination of the milk. Because as you know, Carlos, the milk coming out of the cows or sheep or any breed normally come free of contaminants. And most of the contaminants and to goes into the milk are from the environment where they are. So if you have a parlor, milk room, which is not clean and practices, they are not sanitizing the other the cows and taking all those little steps or extra steps that makes the day of milking a little bit longer, but at the end, you ensure the milk is safer. So with that said, in California, we have very successful program in there to be able not to contaminate the milk environmentally for the milk that I was producing cheese with. And it got to a point where if milk was so clean that I need to kind of allow a little contamination to it so they can bring some character to the milk.
Right. And this is very interesting. This is something that is happening in a lot of places. As you know, for example, in Switzerland, they use raw milk. They don't pasteurize it, but they also their milk collection is so sanitary now that the microbial counts are going down and affecting the flavor. And so it's not necessarily that they're contaminated, but their microbial flora is less active. And is that what you were experiencing in California as well?
Yeah, exactly. They got almost kind of not to the point to be sterile, but we were trying to protect so much the milk, the natural microflora in the area, and can express a little bit of the terroir, we say, it was not there. So we kind of, it was like two steps forward, and we were forced to take one step back so we can, you know, have the quality of milk that we want to develop the flavor that we need into the final cheese. But all that is still was looking at the safe and the healthy, using healthy milk.
Right. And so you talk about the time that you spend in California as part also changing some of the ways that milk was sourced, retraining people and all this. Is that, you think, that the cost to invest in those changes, is that what is stopping other producers from using, you know, from changing to raw milk? Or what would you say is one of the barriers to keep the milk raw?
I don't think so as any barrier to keep it raw. It's just you trying to ensure the quality of the milk you're using and any potential growth or any unwanted bacteria is there. So retraining, it doesn't make any more expensive the milk or any other extra steps. If you are committed to have a product that are safe for the consumer.
Right. So this is really a two process system. You need to have that retraining and work in the parlor to get good milk. But is there something on the cheese make side that also needs to happen once you're receiving that raw milk to ensure that it's not being contaminated then on the other side?
Oh, absolutely. One day you receive the milk, we normally take samples of the milk, so we ensure how clean the milk is, and we work immediately on using the fresh milk. So the first step and the first line of defense to protect the milk will be, you know, start the fermentation with bacteria. They will grow in the milk and over produce, so all their unwanted bacteria are not present in there.
Right.
But you're still having all those lipases and enzymes and normal bacteria. They are present in the milk. They are very helpful for the cheese making. That's what you're trying to protect by inoculating the milk with certain bacteria and start the fermentation right away using nice fresh milk.
Right. So it is also maybe not a pressure, but it is a concern that you are using that milk right away to be able to turn the best product.
Yeah, in Shelburne Farm and also at Fiscalini, I was trying to use the milk within an hour of being finished milk the cows.
Whoa, that's really fast.
that's extremely fast and very make the work of the cheesemaker in order to start the fermentation of the milk much easier. Because as you know, any bacteria in milk, if it's not handling properly, those bacteria triple the counts and the way they multiply in the milk rapidly. So they triple every 20, 45 minutes. They can, you know, you have a environment that you have, let's say, aerobic bacteria you have in there on the level of 1200 CFU, and that can very easily, if you don't, if you hold too long the milk, that can very easily double, triple in quantity, and then makes the cheese making a little bit more difficult.
Right. And so in Grafton, you don't have the control of the milk, but you are pretty sure that that milk is coming to you in a safe way. And so the reason why you are on pasteurizing, not pasteurizing, but heat treating, is because you have a sort of certainty that that milk won't be contaminated, but you also want to control the sort of microbial activity. Is that your first assessment of that?
Yeah, oh, absolutely. It's right. Our source of milk here, we're working right now with around four specific farms that are producing Jersey milk, and a couple are mixed milk from different breeds of animals. But even when you try to work very closely with the farm, those are milk that are produced commercially. So the co-op in the region has to get the milk and sell it to us. Luckily, the co-op in Fiera, Vermont, they are willing to work with us, so we can choose the milk that we want to receive. So that's, let's say, step one of trying to ensure the quality of the milk that we're getting. First, we know the farms, but we don't have to say any in their way of manage their herd or the feed that they have available for the cows. So we work with them in the term of the components and also the microbial counts that they have. But again, we have no control of that. And it all depends of who's milking that day or different things. So the variables are so large, it's so hard to really ensure that you have a extremely high quality milk. So for that reason, we here in Grafton, we desire to heat treat the milk. So with the heat treat, you know, you're not killing everything, but at least you are reducing if it's any potential presence of any pathogens, because at the same time, like I said, I would like to use as fresh as possible. So when they pick the milk, probably is 2-3 hours from the time that they finish milking that particular day, and they bring it to me. But you have to also rely that the contamination can happen anywhere between the farm, the transportation, and unloading the milk into our own cooling system. So the heat treat is basically just to ensure that we can reduce a certain amount of bacteria that are present. Still, if you use that kind of milk, you don't know what the real bacterial content in the milk is, because you have to analyze the milk and do the incubation, the counts, and normally take 36 to 48 hours. So basically, we, not knowing the type of milk that we have that day, we continue and make the cheese. And then if it's something went wrong, well, we need to analyze the cheese and see how the cheese it is. But it's a good measure of safety to be able to heat treat the milk without destroying so many components in the milk.
I understand. Yeah, that's a good way of, I would say, going at it, because not only you have, as you said, all this contamination, or possible contamination points, but you also have, you know, the development of a microbial community that is doubling every, like you say, every half hour almost, you know, in counts. And so you end up with a milk that could potentially have, you know, problems if it started with problems. And then, but you don't know until 36 hours later if that's an issue. From the side of the regulator, I know Vermont is not like New York in this sense, but is on the side of the regulator, you know, a pressure to either pasteurize or heat treat the milk, or is it a sort of hands-off approach?
No, they don't have any to say unless the type of product that you produce. If you're going to produce something that's going to be a fresh product of a very high moisture cheese and things like that, they might enforce, like the law says, you know, if it's, you know, you're going to intend to sell the cheese before 60 days, you'd maybe make sure it's pasteurized. But here in Vermont, we have... luckily, a agriculture department that are willing to work with you in all areas. So they, instead to prevent us from making raw milk, they're encouraged to do what is necessary just to make sure that the product is safe. So they allow us, of course, to, and they come and check all the equipment that we use for heat treatment. So we are pretty well supported by the state and here in Vermont.
Good. All right. This feels like a good time to take a break. We will be right after the voice of our sponsors.
This episode of Cutting the Curd is brought to you by Conte Cheese Association. Conte Cheese Association represents the Conte PDO, Conte Protected Designation of Origin, in the USA. Conte is a raw milk, cooked, pressed cheese from the Jura Mountains of France. There, every day, 2,500 family farms deliver milk to over 150 local cheesemaking facilities, or fruitiers. This milk must be transformed into Conte within 24 hours of milking to preserve the lactic microflora in the milk, ensuring the cheese's aromatic potential. About 105 gallons of milk are required to craft a single wheel of Conte. Conte takes time to acquire its flavors in the affinage cellars. After 8 months of aging by dedicated affineur on average, each wheel of Conte is graded and shipped to market. No wheel of Conte is the same. Its flavors speak to the pastures where the cows grazed, the season in which it was made, the particular craftsmanship of the cheesemaker, and the time spent in the aging cellar. Therefore, every wheel of Conte is unique. Learn more about Conte, an iconic cheese from the Jura Mountains of France, favored by cheesemongers and cheese lovers all over the world. Find out more at conte-usa.com. That's conte-usa.com.
Okay, and we are back. And right now with me, I have Mariano Gonzalez. He is head cheesemaker at Grafton Village Cheese Company. And before the break, he was talking to us about cheese, the process of pasteurization and heat treatment that he knows. We're going to shift a little bit of gears here, and now I'm going to ask him specifically about what he's doing at Grafton. So Mariano, can you tell us what types of cheeses are you making in Grafton, and you know, what is, the second question there is, which one is the one that you enjoy the most making?
Well, let me start a little bit with the Grafton Village Cheese Company is a subsidiary of the Wyndham Foundation. And the Wyndham Foundation is an organization who, their mission is to support small communities and support small farmers and small businesses in the area here. And with that said, with all the cheeses that we make, we also support a small business when they have issues or they need to utilize their milk. We produce cheese for other companies here and for other nonprofit organizations. And we make a variety of cheeses. So mainly cheddars. We make 1 year, 2 year cheddar. We do some smoking, some flavors, and also we utilize sheep milk from a small community of Amish that they are willing to work with us and provide us with excellent sheep milk so we can produce other cheeses. For example, the sheep sock that you like.
Yep.
Is a mix of 50% cow's milk and 50% sheep milk. We also make another cheese that's 100% sheep milk and called Bear Hill. And it's coming very soon, another 100% sheep milk in a format of 3 kilos. It will be named Storyteller. And we're expecting that cheese to be very successful, especially storyteller, the name come from the Daisy Turner is a black woman, daughter of a slave. They move here in the area, and she used to tell stories about moving black people into the community, escaping slaving. So we are pretty excited about that cheese, and it's coming pretty soon. And we've also made some, like I said, cheeses for other company. It's a museum here in Woodstock, Vermont, Billings, and they have a dairy farm to demonstrate agriculture in Vermont. And the excess milk that they have, we make cheese for them for this, for their own store and museum.
That's really cool. I didn't know about that cheese. I knew you manufactured some cheeses for other people, but didn't know that you were making that from that school. I guess that's an interesting connection to what you did or are still doing with the U.S. Aid, and also what you tried to set up in Paraguay. Would you care to share with us about that experience?
In Paraguay?
Yep.
Sure. Sorry, I'm going to make me laugh a little bit because that was a basically a dream that I have with my father, where I learned cheese making. We have a small farm in Paraguay. So anyway, we decided with my wife and I, after working in children farms, and that was a great program to kind of develop some school and cheese making practices and to involve the community and the whole venture. We went to embark in this project, and unfortunately, the time was not the right time. We went over there, we started making cheese, we're trying to develop the program, but then it was a coup.
Yeah, and that's not a good thing to happen when you're trying to set up a new farm.
No, not at all. It's very unfortunate because Paraguay is a country that it needs a lot of help in order to develop the dairy industry over there, mainly is dominated by the Mennonites. They have a big co-ops and they do produce their own product, dairy. And it's almost unheard in Paraguay about aged cheeses unless you import from Argentina or directly from Europe. So that was one of my goals, to introduce aged cheeses in my country. So anyway, the coup came, the vice president got killed, president, you know, went to Brazil, escaped. Everything was chaos and nobody knew what to do or, you know, trying, you know, having the army and the police fighting for power and things like that was not an environment that I want to develop a business and allow my two daughters to kind of be exposed to another culture. And that was not very good. Plus, during that period of time, with all the uncertain, the government or the whoever was in power that week, my milk truck coming from the countryside and to the capital to be processed, they were thinking there'd probably be guns in there or any other type of armament. And they basically opened the valve of my truck and emptied my tank to see if there's any guns inside the tank.
Wow. That must be the most intense moment to lose milk because someone thinks that you have guns in it.
Yeah. And then you have to bribe people and do many other things that was not part of my philosophy. And it got to a point where I was losing tremendous amount of money because, you know, you, in order to ensure your milk, you have to sign contracts with the producer. So when you have a contract, you don't want to let them hang in there either. So I was paying for milk that I was not able to use, and it was just a catastrophe, basically. Right. And my wife and I and my two daughters, we decided to abandon that after 3 years and move back to the United States.
I don't blame you. I think that that's a very difficult situation, and I think the U.S. cheese industry is much better for having you in there.
Yeah, well, I'll tell you one thing. I never regret to do that because it's something that I want to try it, and I did it. I tried it. It wasn't successful, but, you know, I did try it. It was more successful to work with the USAID and other countries and develop different areas. And, you know, that whole combination helped me so much to later on my cheese-making skills and making decisions. And, you know, I'm so, you know, much richer than what it was.
Yeah. Can you share with us a bit of that history, maybe one story of the time that you participated in the Farmer to Farmer program?
Yeah. I was basically invited by the University of Miami to enroll myself with the program of the Farmer to Farmer. So I went to develop they assigned me work with a group of farmers in Honduras. And that was a very interesting experience in the mean of how poorly regulated is in Central America the dairy industry. So anybody does different products without really having much concern about the health of the product or the way it's making products in some of those countries and on the rural level. So I went there and I met with this fantastic group of farmers that they were trying to create a cooperative, because also the milk over there is, like I say, it's not regulated the way you transport, the way you sell it. And so that presents numerous inconvenience, because you as a farmer, you have your milk that you're trying to sell, and then you are exposed to who's going to buy your milk, and they don't have a price structure for the milk. So in many cases, they were not even making enough money to be able to feed the cows. And so my goal with the Farmer to Farmer work to go and develop this small co-op and show them how to utilize the milk, how to treat the milk, and most importantly, how to add value to the milk. You know, making cheese or yogurt or any other different products. But in the same time, you face a lot of challenges in there because they are not, they don't have the right equipments to be able to develop this set for making home cheese making or something like that. So We went there. It was very good experience for both myself and the group that I work with. So it was so well that the USAID decided to send me back to do a follow-up and continues to develop the program.
That's nice. Do you know if that cheese is for sale now in the United States?
I lost contact with them. Basically, at this point, I don't have a contact info to see if how they continue to develop, because it was a certain other challenge in there. So they basically desire to stick with some local products.
Right.
Like making what the people know. And instead of trying to make new products, they desire to stick with what the community likes. So they're still making some quesillo and some fresh cheeses.
That's interesting. And I asked because very recently, maybe 3 months ago, I was contacted by someone in Honduras saying that they had product in the United States and they wanted to see if I could help them find a distributor. So anyway, that's an interesting sideway there. I think this is all the time that we have today. I know that there's so much more to talk, but we only have limited time in the show. I want to thank you, Mariano, for your time, for all your knowledge and sharing your experience with us today.
It was a pleasure, Carlos. Anytime.
Perfect.
Cutting the Curd is powered by Simplecast. Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. Keep in touch at heritageradionetwork.org/subscribe.
Hi, listeners. We want to tell you about a podcast we're really digging. It's called Christopher Kimball's Milk Street Radio. Every week, they travel the world to find the most fascinating stories about food, including children who harvest cod tongues after school in Norway and a detective who tracks down food thieves. And on Milk Street Radio, you can always find the unexpected. The comedian who ranks apples using an elaborate 100-point system, the secret history of grocery stores, and how to eat your way through Italy. They also interview the most beloved names in food like Jacques Pepin, Sola Aweli, Jose Andres, Jet Tila, Ina Garten, Nigella Lawson, and Padma Lakshmi. Plus, co-hosts Christopher Kimball and Sarah Moulton do live calls with listeners and answer their questions about ingredients, techniques, and culinary mysteries. Like, why roasting a leg of lamb made one caller's oven explode? Ever wonder why your bread won't rise or your souffle falls flat? Chris and Sarah have the answers. You'll also hear from a rotating cast of contributors, including Kenji Lopez-Alt, Cheryl Day, Dan Pashman from The Sporkful, and Alex Inouz, a French guy cooking from YouTube. Take a listen at 177milkstreet.com/radio or just search your podcast app for Milk Street Radio.